her for almost 65 years. And I've come to learn about the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study. I believe it's one of the longest running studies in the United States. And we'll learn a little bit more about the history of the study and what the findings have been in these 65 years as scientists from the University of Wisconsin have followed more than 10,000 men and women who graduated from high school in Wisconsin in 1957. I find this fascinating, and I think it's also kind of revelatory for us as we're starting a new year in 2022 to kind of understand what life in our state has been, at least for this significant group of people, for the last 65 years. So this morning, I'd like to welcome Dr. Carol Rowan, who is a lead scientist in the operation of the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study and the study's director, along with Dr. Michal Engelman, who is the principal investigator of the study. Welcome to our show, Carol and Michal.
Thank you, Laura, and thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Sure. I think the best way to start our conversation today is to hear a little bit about the history of the study itself. And Carol, as the study's director, I think I'm going to hand it off for you to enlighten us about how this came to be and what it has, you know, what the history of this longitudinal 65-year study is for us.
Sure, Laura. So as you mentioned before, anybody who was in high school in 1957 and was a senior was eligible to be a part of the study. But more specifically, the study really didn't intend to be a 65-year study. Back in 1957, an education professor at UW-Madison named J. Kenneth Little wanted to know about the high school senior population. And his motivation was to get more interest in young people to attend college, as well as to plant the seeds of what we now know today as the UW system. So he frankly just administered a paper and pencil questionnaire to all 30,000 high school seniors in the spring of 1957. And I believe those studies were used to, as I said earlier, decide where to put all these campuses. But now we are entering our seventh wave of actually talking to those 18-year-olds who filled out those studies in 1957. But in between that, I have to mention that in 1964, the first follow-up of these high school seniors was done by Bill Sewell, who at one time was chancellor of UW-Madison. But Professor Sewell wanted to look at the success of these students and see what has happened to them in the intervening years. And he discovered these questionnaires literally in the basement of Bascom Hall, which is an administrative building here on campus. And they were at risk of being sent to a landfill or burned or something. And he said, wait a second, let me take a look. And he found the names of one of the seniors' parents and had a good idea of where they lived. So instead of talking to the high school student or the now graduate or alum of the high school, he talked to the parent. And he sent out this very elegant postcard to say, basically ask what the student had been up to in the intervening years. And interesting enough for today's audience, for the male students, he asked about their occupation and what they might be doing now. But however, for the female students, he asked about their spouse's occupation. So that is a sign of the times. But the first time we would actually have talked to a graduate, and that's how I refer to the class of 1957, would have been in 1975. And in 75, my predecessors on the study did an all-out effort to actually find the people who were seniors in 1957. And we did have a little bit of information about them from the parents in 1964, But in 1975, we were able to talk to close to 90% of the original graduating class. And when I say close to 90%, I need to clarify that in 1957, there were about 30,000 high school seniors. And when Bill Sewell did his follow-up, he knew he couldn't afford to talk to all 30,000. So he did basically a one-third random selection. So we have about 10,000 people in the 1964 and the 1975 wave. And that is, in a nutshell, the origins of the study. And from then, even at the time of 1975, there was really no intention of following up again after 1975. But the success of that study was so great, not solely due to the talents of the faculty who ran the study at the time, but to the enthusiasm from the participants themselves, from the grads themselves. They were very friendly and willing to talk to us, and we were very excited about the results that we got. So in the mid-1990s, we got some grant money from the federal government to talk to them again. And even more interesting, in the 1990s, we're like, well, I wonder how these students in 1957 compare to their brothers and sisters. How much of their life outcomes are similar to their brothers and sisters, and how much of it differ between brothers and sisters? So to answer that question, all along, we decided, hey, let's talk to one of the brothers and sisters too. So we really expanded the sample about 1994 to include a brother and sister of the original participant. And then we went forward with interviews with both the original graduate and the brother and sister from then, that time forward. The content of the study, to reflect the interest of the principal investigators, started out with education and occupation to begin with, and things that are very important in early life. But all along, we've collected information about family, including marital status and number of children. And then moving forward, as the participants age, our interest in what we wanted to ask them about change, depending because of the changes in where they are in the life cycle. So more recently, we're more interested in health, in memory and thinking, as well as also, I will pause to say that a former PI of the study, Bob Hauser, who was PI for many years, used to say that the WLS, or the abbreviation we use for Wisconsin Longitudinal Study, is about everything. So it's really kind of hard to talk about the topics of the study, but we do ask questions about the community organizations participants have been members of and active in. We've asked about voting history. We've asked about their recreational activities. And then more meat and bones of sociology and economics, like labor force participation and work history and what their job is like. And then again, like I said, most recently, we're really most interested in health and the early life consequences that we know from talking to them when they were 18. We can look at that and see how that might impact their current health today. And even more recently, that involves memory and thinking, really looking at using participants at this level and at this age to try to get some really interesting research questions answered about what is going on with memory and thinking of people this age, which is now about 82 or 83, I believe.
It's amazing, as you've described, Carol, the effort to find the participants so many years after the fact, without the aid of what we enjoy today in the internet. It makes things a whole lot speedier to contact people or find people and rediscover where they've located. But I can't even imagine the effort that it took to locate at least 90% of the participants in the 70s, almost 20 years after they first talked with them. And that's quite a magnificent feat in itself. I'm looking forward to understanding what kinds of maybe the top most interesting trends that perhaps you've discovered through your time with these participants. And Michal, you might be able to enlighten us a little bit about some of the findings that the study has revealed to us.
Sure, yeah. So I want to start just by saying that, you know, it's sometimes, you know, when we work with this data for as long as we have, we sometimes forget how extraordinary this is. And I think it's worthwhile for folks to know, especially people listening in, that the WLS, as we call it, the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study, is the longest running study of its kind in the United States, and the most comprehensive. So there are a lot of studies out there that try to find out information about populations and people and link them to a bunch of outcomes that have to do with well-being and health. But there is no other study in the United States that has followed people for as long as the WLS has, and whose participants have been so wonderful about agreeing to continue speaking with the researchers over time. And so that has really given us an amazing advantage in the study relative to others, because we are really able to look at how experiences that people had when they were young, right, when they were high school students, as well as information that we've collected from them about their families and their households as they were growing up, how all of that ends up linking up with outcomes in terms of their subsequent education and their career, their family life, their participation in the community and in health later on. As Carol was saying, so we've been able to look at how early life experiences influence these outcomes in adulthood and in later life, and also because we have over time, as Carol mentioned, spoken to siblings and also in some ways spoken to people's spouses and partners, we really have this incredible breadth and depth in the data, both over time and in terms of the relationships that we've been able to explore. And so because the study has been going on for as long as it has, in many ways it's kind of shifted and grown with the participants. So as you heard before, this started out really as a study trying to understand educational aspirations, right? What do high school students think about their long-term education prospects? And over time, as the study continued, the investigators first asked is, well, you know, how well did what people say they wanted to do match up with what happens? And so there were a lot of studies in the 70s and into the 80s and 90s that looked at information about how people's experiences in high school, basically their grades, the type of activities that they were involved with in high school, clubs and organizations, the type of courses that they took, their curricula and their grades, how all of that related to what types of jobs they ended up having and what kinds of and how they felt about those jobs. We also looked at the way in which that relating to earnings and to income and wealth. And we also asked over the years a lot of questions about family and social relations, right? So Carol told you that in early on, they asked the men about their jobs and the women about their families. But over time, we asked everyone about everything. And so we have a lot of information about people's family ties, about their marriages and histories, their relationship quality, the time they spent together. And also about things like what organizations they were members in, what activities did they enjoy and hobbies, different religious organizations that they participated in, and also about sort of challenges that they met in their family life in terms of things like, you know, caregiving and other sort of difficulties that they and family members came to. And so we were able to really look at how these experiences that they told us about related to the types of to their to their childhood background or to their adolescent background, and also to then later on see how these midlife characteristics, social and economic and family characteristics, how those related to health later on. And so in terms of the findings, early on, a lot of the really notable findings from the study really focused on what kinds of characteristics determine educational and occupational success. And there have been some studies that showed that what really mattered, in addition to people's own individual aspirations, was the degree of sort of encouragement that they received from parents to pursue additional education or particular careers. But also importantly, beyond those sort of very individual or family level factors, the study was also able to show that there were big differences in terms of people's socioeconomic status in childhood and their parents' socioeconomic status and how that related to their likelihood of continuing to achieving additional education and the types of occupations that they ended up later on. And that was really informative over time, as there had been sort of policy debates about how to increase access to higher education over time, the ability to draw on studies, not only the WLS, but the WLS was a contributor to these conversations that helped shape policy decisions about making loans, for example, more available to students and to subsequent generations, so that more people are able to access things like a college education, even if they came from families where perhaps the parents didn't already have a college degree. And so that was a really important outcome. And then there was a series of other influential studies that showed how things like grades, which you may have thought of, but also other characteristics like the types of activities that people were involved in high school, how popular they were and how they characterized their personality and relationship with friends, how those ended up shaping people's success in the labor market in terms of their jobs, their satisfaction with their jobs, and their earnings over time. And then more recently, as the cohort has grown older and as the questions that we ask in the interviews have shifted more to thinking about health, there have been a lot more there's been a lot more emphasis on health in later life. And so again, we're able to draw back on this long long-term data that we have over time to show that people who sort of that people's grades in high school and their popularity and their ties and well-being and sort of social connections with their friends are related to the health they report in later life. There have been some other studies that have looked at how different kinds of behaviors, like people's level of exercise, and even you know whether they occasionally drink alcohol or not, how those things are related to their health, and both their physical health and their cognitive health in later life. And also a lot of really interesting studies about people's intergenerational relationships. So how people's kind of characteristics and their experiences over the life course are related to their own health, and also kind of the way that they characterize the way that their relationships with their sons and daughters. And I'll pause there. I could actually be for a much longer time, because the WLS has generated over the years thousands upon thousands of scholarly articles and conference presentations and reports. So it's difficult to encompass it all in words. Maybe just one way of summarizing it is to say that it repeatedly gets cited in research publications and by sort of the national academies as just an extraordinary study that has really is one of the foundational contributions to understanding health and well-being across the life course in America.
I can only imagine. So you have this tremendous data resource, and we have so many questions about life that are ongoing and evolving, as you've mentioned, even just our memory health as people age is such a key point of study as people are living longer. And so I'm kind of curious of, as to whether or not you have people, researchers coming to you all the time to see if they could look at your data in order to answer maybe a prevailing question that they want to research right now and look in hindsight to things like, academic success, life trajectory, socioeconomic status, and because you have such a long-running history of that among the participants in this program, and it's such a wide pool, like roughly a third of the graduates from high school in 1957, if I'm not mistaken, were part of the initial study. Do you have people coming to you who are researchers who want to build on kind of that foundational understanding you have to answer next generation questions that are coming up?
Yeah, absolutely, all the time. So I'll say, the folks, like me and the prior principal investigator, Dr. Pamela Hurd, and before her, Dr. Bill Hauser, Jim Hauser, they have always spearheaded a number of really innovative studies with the data, but the as I mentioned before, the impact of the study has been enormous, and that's partially because all along our commitment as a study has been to make these data available to researchers from all over the place and from many, many different disciplines. And so the studies that have been conducted by folks in with backgrounds in sociology, in public health, in economics, in public policy, in psychology. We even have, one of the things that we have is biomarker data. So we've got people with backgrounds in biology and genetics who are interested in the data, as well as people with a whole variety of different specializations in the medical sciences as well. And so the study has really been enormously productive, and allowed people to learn about the determinants of health and well-being from a lot of different disciplinary perspectives. And we've got researchers requesting to use the data from all across the United States and globally. And in fact, a lot of what Carol spends a lot of her time doing is really facilitating access to that data and figuring out how we can truly make this data a resource for researchers globally to understand more about determinants of health and aging, while at the same time, of course, always keeping the privacy and confidentiality of individual respondents.
And the other thing I find interesting is, are you, I don't know how you would know this, but obviously the study is focused on Wisconsinites. What kinds of differences do you think exist geographically among the participants that might cause complications to, extrapolate ideas that would cross all of humankind across the globe from the people that you say are looking worldwide, and sometimes their studies to determine things about health and well-being. Is there something particular about Wisconsinites that seem to rise to the surface through all of these studies that have been conducted so far, or that might play a role in what it means to live here?
It's a really good question. So, I think maybe one way of starting to answer is that we know that the folks in the study were all living in Wisconsin in 1957 when the original survey has started. But over time, not necessarily everyone has stayed here. And so we follow participants across wherever they have gone. So the majority have indeed stayed in Wisconsin, and are still living in the States. But something Carol might have the exact percentage at the moment, but something like a 30% or so of the folks who were in Wisconsin in 1957, who were still following up, live outside of the state of Wisconsin. And so they've really spread out across the country and the globe. But in many ways, yes, this is a quintessentially Wisconsin study, right? It tells us a lot about the life course, specifically of people who were living in the Midwest during their high school years, and many who continued to be here. And so we have, you know, always in scientific communication about the study made really clear that, you know, we don't claim to generalize from the experience of people who live here for the experiences of everyone across, you know, throughout the world. People have lots of different experiences, obviously, but we think it's still instructive to be able to say something about how people's early and midlife experiences relate to their well-being in later life, even while realizing that things may differ for some people. So I think it's useful to think about what kinds of relationship may be informative and applicable to people across context, and what other relationships may be really shaped by the specific context of living in Wisconsin and being here. And so on, I would say on the one hand, people across the world have been really interested in a lot of the health measurements and thinking about how the processes of, you know, sort of change over time in people's health may be related to a variety of other variables that we have. But in other ways, people have also noted that this is a very particular sample, and we maybe can't say that growing up in Wisconsin is the same as growing up in Georgia, or the same as growing up in California, or the same as growing up in Argentina, right? There's definitely differences. And one thing that actually the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study is thinking about moving forward is, at some point, we're in the process of trying to recruit more participants to the study who will tell us about diverse experiences of aging in Wisconsin among different populations, not all of whom may have been here when they were high school seniors in 1957, but many of whom are living and aging in the state now, and can help us think about what are the ways in which paths of aging and health in Wisconsin are similar and different for different groups.
I just want to remind our listeners that you're listening to WGTD's Community Matters, and this morning we're talking to Dr. Carol Rowan and Dr. Michal Engelman, who are with the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study. The most recent, if you can maybe zero in on some of the most recent studies that are that are being conducted or have been conducted on this cohort, would that include then memory questions and thinking questions as people age? And if so, have there been any major suggestions from looking at that data at this time?
Sure. Yeah. So I can tell you that, you know, the WLS has actually collected data on people's cognition for a while using different measures over time, and so studies have looked at things. So for, I can give you an example of a study actually that was just published last week that looked at the relationship between the types of activities that people were involved in when they were in high school, and the way in which those things are related to how people perform on memory and cognitive tests in adulthood. And that study actually found really interestingly that people who were involved in activities that were sort of the participated in activities that had a strong cognitive component, so things like orchestra or band or singing in a choir or musical ensemble, or things like drama or speech and debate club, student government, and then sort of publication clubs and honorary organizations, as well as community service and school assistance clubs, that they ended up, you know, these are activities that people were participating in when they were in high school, right? So in their teens, that it turned out that folks who participated in those types of activities had higher cognitive scores when they were in their 60s and 70s relative to people who didn't participate in those kinds of activities. Now, you know, there were also definitely other benefits to folks who participated in sports, like varsity clubs and intramural athletics and also other benefits that accrued to people who participated in social activities, like, you know, sort of like homecoming or prom court and hobby club and pep groups. So that there were different benefits in different realms associated with those kinds of activities, but we definitely are seeing that the people who, even in, you know, a very young age, showed involvement in these kinds of enriching early life activities have been have shown that those cognitive benefits last into later life.
I also wonder, given the scope of the study and the age of the participants now, as Carol mentioned, they're 82, 83 years old right now. Have any of the studies looked at independent living, and if many of those remaining in the cohort are still living on their own? As opposed to needing assisted living care or nursing home care. And we ought to also mention, if you have an idea of how many of those participants are still alive at this time.
Yeah, so Carol, I don't know if you have the specific numbers on these.
I do. So currently, we know that of the original graduates, about 65% are alive and 35% have died. And I will mention that there's a bit of a lag in our ability to measure mortality. So those numbers are current as of, I believe, the end of 2019. And our 2020 and 2021 numbers are coming along. We're very careful about this very important measure, because we want to make sure, well, it's all of our measures, but we really want to make sure that we get this right, because it is such an important measure.
That's pretty fascinating that about 65% of the graduates are still alive. Do you have any idea about their independence? At this time, did any of the studies take a look at if they're still living independently?
We do measure their housing arrangements. And for the most part, we haven't been able to look at this in detail since we talked to them around 2011. So that those data are a little stale right now. And as we are in the field right now asking a new set of questions, we will be able to update that. But as of 2011, everybody is pretty much independent, except those who've had some earlier health challenges. And a lot of our graduates are not only independent, but they're helping take care of maybe their brothers or sisters or their children or their spouses, and helping them to be able to live independently. Because perhaps as your listeners are aware, we want to live in our homes, our own homes, as long as we can. And that's not different for the people in our study. So that's what we continue to find. And I hope to be able to update you once the data from the latest round comes in.
One thing I can add to that, Laura, is that it's really interesting to note. So Carol mentioned that about 65% of the original sample is alive. If we compare that to overall the number of people who were born in the same year in the United States, so of the folks in the U.S. who were born in 1939, the percent who are still alive of the same age group is about 58. And so that difference of the 65% relative to the 58% overall suggests that the WLS participants, these graduates, are doing really well in comparison to members of their cohort. And we don't, you know, that's actually a really interesting question that other studies are trying to dig into more? Is it that they're just a really special bunch and people born in Wisconsin are hardy and live longer than folks elsewhere? There's also a question of whether participating in the study itself has kind of been a benefit to people potentially over time, that checking in and kind of being aware of how people are doing over time may be of interest as well. So we don't know the answer to that, but we do know that the folks who have stuck through us and with the study over time are doing a little bit better than the general population their age.
Well, for those of us who live in Wisconsin, that might be really good news. I'm curious, Carol, you had mentioned something about studies currently in the field. How many studies are going on right now that concern the WLS participants? Are there multiple studies going on it simultaneously?
I'm not quite sure how you're using the word study. I mean, there are definitely researchers who are analyzing the data we've already collected all the time, which we distribute freely to qualified researchers who have a good research question. But currently we are in the field, meaning we are partnered with the University of Wisconsin Survey Center, who are actively calling participants, most participants, to really look at how their lives are going currently and to concentrate on questions about memory and thinking. Something unique to the WLS right now, and we've always been a study to push the envelope, is that Pamela Hurd has partnered with Sanjay Astana, who is a cognitive researcher here at the School of Medicine and Public Health at UW-Madison. And what that has allowed us to do is use some of the testing that Dr. Astana has used with his panel of people he is studying, to use that on the WLS participants. And this is important because the people that Dr. Astana has had access to or has been able to talk to are people that have been recruited basically through family members of patients he sees in clinic, or people who might be wandering around, let's say, the UW hospital or a hospital anywhere in the state of Wisconsin, and said, hey, are you interested in participating in a study about Alzheimer's in particular, or dementia, or anything like that? So we are using the same measures he uses, although we can't quite use them as directly as he does, in terms of we don't quite have the whole battery of tests that he uses, and we're not using quite the same protocols. But some of the tests that we can do over the phone now, and in part because of the COVID pandemic, we've had to go completely over the phone instead of in person, we can use his expertise and his questions to ask our participants. So instead of a sample of people who are just what we would call a convenient sample, by recruiting WLS participants to answer these questions for this wave, we have a population-based sample. And the difference between that is extreme. I mean, you get to ask much more, much different research questions when you have a sample of our type, as compared to the sample he's worked with in the past.
So if somebody were interested in seeing the studies that have come out of the WLS, is there a place where they can go and see what has, what the participation of these high school graduates who made the decision to do this back in 1957, what that has meant for expanding our knowledge about life in general? Like you said, it covers just about every question you could possibly imagine. Is there a place where people can go to discover what conclusions have come out of some of these studies?
Yeah, so we are actually in the process of updating our website. So in there will soon be a newer one, but we have been over the years keeping track of research articles that come out using the WLS, and a list of them is posted on the WLS website, and it will be an even more updated and more user-friendly website, hopefully in the near future, as we're currently working on it.
Is there anything else that you can think about the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study that would be of interest of our listeners that we should touch on before we conclude our conversation today? Is there something that you want to make sure everybody understands or knows about or has been revealed by this, all the numerous studies done?
I'll go first. I just want to make sure that your audience understands that it's the participants, actually themselves, the people who have given their time to answer our questions. And of course, we allow anybody who doesn't want to answer our questions anymore, or during the course of an actual interview, doesn't want to answer a subset of our questions. They are within their right, and we invite them to just say, no, I don't really want to answer that question. But most people, by far, are very willing to talk to us and very gracious with their time. And in exchange, we protect their confidentiality. Anybody who has access to the data to answer their research questions do not know participants' names or any contact information. But again, it's the participants themselves that have made the study as wonderful as it is today.
Absolutely. I also want to echo what Carol said and really emphasize that, right? So the strength of the study and what makes it so unique has been the participants' dedication and commitment and willingness to talk to researchers over time. And in doing so, they have shared their really valuable life stories and then contributed to this enormous resource that informs science. And this is really interesting, because sometimes participating in a research study isn't always obvious to everyone why that might be beneficial, right? And so we have over the years heard from our participants that they really enjoy being part of the study, and they enjoy speaking with the Survey Center interviewers who contact them and to share their information. And so there's a satisfaction that people get from sharing what they've learned and what they've been through, and knowing that informs researchers and really kind of all of us in Wisconsin and beyond. But it's also really useful as you think about how the research that comes out informs subsequent policy discussions. Like, the benefits go far beyond the participants themselves, right? They inform policies that can make things better, right? They can inform investment in things like where should universities be placed in the UW system. They inform debates about whether there should be loans available to help people attend college, and they inform information that we now understand about what kinds of early life experiences are associated with better physical health and better mental and cognitive health in later life. And they inform what we understand about how people's sort of own relationships with their children affect their health and well-being later on. And so in that sense, like, the participants have just made an enormous impact on many, many fields of science, and we're just grateful for all of that.
Yes, their contributions are enormous when you think about all of the studies that have come out of this original idea to talk to high school graduates in 1957, and I'm sure I speak on behalf of Wisconsinites who are thankful for the two of you who are continuing to be custodians of this data set and of this opportunity to continue to deeper learn about our life experiences through this some set of Wisconsin residents who have been so generous with their time. So I thank you for the work you do. I thank you for taking time today to explain a little bit of it to us. And I'm hoping that some of our listeners who are curious about the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study will go to your website and discover more yet and be on the watch for other decisions that come out of further study of the participants. So thank you so much for your time today, and we'll be watching to see what emerges from the study going forward.
Thanks so much for having us. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Laura.